So I'm going to read John 11 from verse 17. On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. Lord, Martha said to Jesus, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha answered, I know he'll rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live, even though he dies. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? Yes, Lord, she told him. I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who was to come into the world. And after she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. The teacher is here, she says, and is asking for you. When Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who had been with Mary in the house, comforting her, noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Where have you laid him? He asked. Come and see, Lord, they replied. Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, see how he loved him. But some of them said, could not he, who opened the eyes of a blind man, have kept this man from dying? Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. Take away the stone, he said. But Lord, said Martha, the sister of the dead man, by this time there is a bad odor, for he has been there 4 days. Then Jesus said, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me. When he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, take off the grave clothes and let them go.
Please take a seat. Thank you very much for having me. If I'm a strange face, which I may well be to some of you, my name's Ian Taylor. I go along to Emmanuel Bishopston. And it'd be great help if you could keep your Bibles open as we look at this question of is Christianity is a crutch? And we could just kind of answer that question. I could kind of give you 10 interesting things about that. But what we want to do is take a passage of the Bible and see what it has to say in answer to that question. And if, as I go along, you've got a burning question that I don't answer, store it up and we'll try and deal with it afterwards in question time. Just over a month ago, my cousin gave birth to a little boy called Theo, and Theo was born with spina bifida, which is a condition which might mean that he'll live the rest of his life with a physical and mental disability. And it did mean that he, within the first week of his life, he needed 2 operations. He needed one on his spine and one on his brain, which is pretty serious stuff. And during the first few days of Theo's life, his dad sent out some emails just to kind of keep us updated with what was going on. And here's an excerpt from one of them. Just before his brain surgery, Theo had to be nil by mouth for 4 hours. It wasn't long before he became hungry and started crying. But there was nothing we could do. All he wanted was to feed, but we couldn't give him anything. So I held him in my arms and told him that I loved him and told him to trust me that this was for the best. We don't know why our little boy was born with spina bifida, and we don't know what the future will bring. But we trust that God is holding us in his hands and that he knows better than us. And I suppose the question that begs to be asked to that email is God really holding them in his hands? Or is Christianity just a crutch for them? A nice idea that makes it easier for them to sort of cope with very understandable grief. A comforting idea. And not just for them, but for all Christians. Is Christianity a crutch for all Christians? Do we believe because we prefer the idea of a loving God to a universe of randomly ordered atoms? And Sigmund Freud once described religion as a sort of classic example of wish fulfillment. So the theory goes, because we sort of feel the need for love, we want security, we create a God who loves us, and we create a God who keeps us safe. And so Christianity sort of arises from inside us and our feelings, rather than from the facts out there. And if that's true, then aren't Christians just wasting their time? Right, wouldn't we be much better off just sitting at home watching TED Talks and getting some insight that way, or sitting outside in the sunshine? Well, as we look at this passage in John this afternoon, I want us to see two things in response to this question of whether Christianity is a crutch. The first is this: Jesus' promise brings comfort. Jesus' promise brings comfort. Secondly, Jesus' power brings comfort. His power brings comfort. So firstly, Jesus' promise brings comfort. Now, at the start of a passage, we find two sisters, Mary and Martha, struggling to get to grips with the death of their brother Lazarus. And back at the start of chapter 11, they've sent word to Jesus saying, look, Lazarus is really ill. You've got to come quickly. But by the time that Jesus arrives to meet Mary and Martha, verse 17 tells us Lazarus has been dead, and actually he's been dead for 4 days, so Jesus is well out of time. And so verse 21, if you have a look down, the first thing that Martha says to Jesus was, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't have died. She'd pinned all her hopes on Jesus being able to help, but he's too late. And any sort of flicker of hope for Lazarus is long gone. But that's not how Jesus sees it. Have a look down, verse 23. He says to Martha, your brother will rise again. It's not over, Martha. You will see him. To which Martha responds, she goes, I know I'll see him in the resurrection at the last day. Now, just like any Jew at the time, Martha believed the day would come when God would finally wrap up history. And all his people, all those who followed him, would be raised in a general way. So there was Martha, clinging to this slightly vague hope of life after death. But a hope nonetheless. And this instinct to search for comfort in the face of suffering and death. It's something that's still with us today, isn't it? Isn't that why quite a few people, in the face of death or suffering, say, well, I know he's somewhere better. I know he's somewhere better. Aren't they trying to sort of find comfort in a hope that a friend or family member who's died is somewhere better? You see, when difficult times come, it's not just Christians who need a crutch. It is, in fact, everyone. We all tend to look somewhere for something, don't we? So the BBC broadcaster, Jonathan Humphreys, who is an agnostic, he's written, don't we all need support? Some use the Bible, others use booze. And the issue isn't so much whether some people have crutches or others don't. The issue is more kind of, well, what kind of crutch do you have? What kind of support do you rely on? And, you know, there are a number of ways you could probably try and answer that question. But here's one way of figuring out what crutch you might have. Imagine you're watching a news story, and as is so often the case these days, there's something particularly tragic on the news. And if you're anything like me, when you come across a story a bit like that, your gut instinct can be, that's terrible. At least I've got my family. At least I've got my job. At least I've got a home. At least I've got something. These are the crutches. These are the sorts of things which actually we're relying on. These are the sort of things which, if they were taken from us, might cause us to despair. And for Martha, her comfort is thinking, I will see Lazarus at some point in the future. That's where her hope is. And in response to this, Jesus says something absolutely remarkable. Verse 25, if you take a look down, Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live, even though he dies. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Now, what is he talking about? It's a well-quoted verse, but it's not immediately obvious. You see, here's Martha, and she's in the midst of his grief. And suddenly Jesus goes, hello, I am the resurrection and the life. What does he mean? How can Jesus be resurrection? It just doesn't make sense. But I think what he's trying to say is this. Martha, you're looking forward to that final day of resurrection. I get it. But without me, there is no resurrection. Think about it this way. Let's say the tech company Apple. Okay, we all know Apple. If I were to ask you, what person do you most associate with Apple? I'm guessing a lot of us here would say Steve Jobs, wouldn't we? There is a sense in which we can say Steve Jobs is Apple, or at least was Apple. Now, when we say Steve Jobs is Apple, we're not saying he is literally the company Apple, are we? We're just saying he is so intimately associated with Apple that without him, Apple would never have existed, okay? No Steve Jobs, no Apple. According to verse 25, no Jesus, no resurrection, and no life after death. He is so tightly bound up with resurrection and life after death that it's just not possible to have either without him. You believe in the resurrection, Martha. You want life after death. Come to me. I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me will live, even though he dies. You see, Martha, she's clinging to this idea. She's clinging to an idea of one day seeing Lazarus. Jesus is saying, Martha, you're holding on to an idea. You need to hold on to me. And he's not saying it in a kind of lean on me, I'll be a shoulder to cry on. He's not being her therapist. He's offering her something solid and specific. If she trusts in him, she can have absolute certainty of life after death. She can have absolute certainty of seeing her brother. Jesus is offering Martha a crutch that will not be kicked from under her when she dies. One of my favorite films is called Fight Club with Brad Pitt and Ed Norton. And during one of the scenes, the narrator, he says, on a long enough timeline, the survival rate for everyone drops to zero. In other words, death comes to all of us. Okay? We've seen the wealthy trying to dodge taxes in Panama, but no one can dodge death. And when death comes knocking, any crutch we have that is not Jesus will be kicked from under us. Our fulfilling job, our academic success, our loving family, They may provide support for us on a day-to-day basis, and they do, but actually, there'll be many of us here who will know what it's like to have some of those crutches pulled from under us, and it's not pleasant, and it does expose the frailty of life. But even if we manage to have a happy and fulfilling life, none of those crutches will take our weight when death comes. Except Jesus, who says, "I am the resurrection and the life." Anyone who believes in Jesus can be assured of life after death. Now, isn't that hope that brings comfort? Isn't that a crutch that you want to lean on? Isn't that something much more specific than saying, "I know he's going to a better place"? Now, I think there are two ways you could hear this and kind of block what Jesus is saying, okay? So the first is to go, "Yeah, well, of course I want to believe in life after death, don't we all? Yeah, but just because I want to believe in it doesn't make it true. So I want the summer to be 4 months of wall-to-wall sunshine, of course I do. But just saying that is not going to stop the clouds blocking the sun." And many will dismiss Jesus' claims because they just don't think they're based on any evidence, okay? A bit like jelly. You know, it might be quite sweet and quite nice, but there's just no real substance to it. So that's one way of blocking what Jesus says here. Yeah, sure, of course it might give us comfort, but it's just not true. And so actually, we're just back where we started. It's just wish fulfillment. It's just like, well, it makes you feel better, but it's not true. There's a second way, of course, you could block it, and it goes a bit like this. To be honest, it doesn't really matter whether what Jesus here is saying is true or not. If what Jesus says works for you, then that's brilliant. Who cares if it works for you? Does it matter if it's not true? Now, you might be thinking, well, how does that undermine what Jesus is saying here? But the "if it works for you" view, of course, relies on there being no real truth that applies to everyone. As long as my view works for me, your view works for you, let's all just agree our views are all good and no view is better than the other. And the Welsh band, the Manic Street Preachers, put it well when they said, "This is my truth, you tell me yours." So someone might say, I think your faith is wonderful. Actually, for me, what's kind of important is just living my life well and being a good person. And boom, that kind of thinking straight away just sort of shuffles Jesus into the kind of self-help category, doesn't it? Into a kind of take it or leave it. It might work for you. But I want us to see that what happens next in our passage blows both of those views out the water. Jesus shows, firstly, that he has the credentials to speak about life after death. And what he says is true. And secondly, what happens with Lazarus is not a take it or leave it event. It's something that affects everyone, and it changes everything. So Jesus' promise brings comfort. He says, "I am the resurrection and the life. If you believe in me, you can have assurance of life after death." Secondly, Jesus' power brings comfort. Jesus' power brings comfort. So Jesus has met Martha, and it's not long before Mary arrives, and she bursts into tears in front of Jesus. Have a look down, verse 33. "When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. 'Where have you laid him?' he asked. 'Come and see, Lord,' they replied. Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, 'See how he loved him.'" And as Jesus surveys the sorrowful scene, verse 35, he can't help weeping. He responds to Martha with truth and Mary with tears. But Jesus is more than just a shoulder to cry on here. Verse 33 describes him as being deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Now, apparently, to be more accurate, sort of Greek translators would suggest that translation is, it just should be stronger. It should read, "Jesus was outraged in anger." So he looks around him and sees the suffering, and he's outraged, and he's angry. Now, why? You might think, oh, of course, well, Lazarus has died, of course. But he knows exactly what's about to happen with Lazarus. So it's probably not that. Probably it's because his anguish actually goes much deeper, much deeper. He's outraged by death itself. He can't be at every tomb. He can only be at Lazarus's tomb. When King Edward VII died in 1910, the minister who conducted the funeral described death like this. He said, "It's so inexplicable, so ruthless, so blundering, the cruel ambush into which we're snared. It makes its horrible breach in our gladness with careless and inhuman disregard for us. Dumb as the night, that terrifying silence." In 2005, my sister died very suddenly of a massive stroke, aged just 24. I remember, I suppose of course you'd remember it well, but I was watching the England victory parade in September for the Ashes. They'd just won the Ashes in 2005. 1 minute I was in the lounge watching that, and the next minute I was in her bedroom as death stole her away. And in the months after that, I remember thinking, you know, I could search every square of this planet and I wouldn't find her because she's gone. So I hope you can see that as Jesus approaches Lazarus's tomb in verse 39, that he's going to face up to a monster. He's going to face up to the monster who got Lazarus, to the monster who got my sister, and he's going to face up to the monster that will get every single one of us. And that's why when Jesus asks for the stone to be rolled away, verse 39, Martha's really confused. "Lazarus is dead, Jesus. You're too late. His body's rotting. What do you think you're doing?" But Jesus wants the stone rolled away, so it is. And verse 43, these are some of the best verses in the Bible. "He called out in a loud voice, 'Lazarus, come out.' The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. And Jesus said to them, 'Take off the grave clothes and let him go.'" See, the one who was 4 days dead is now alive. Now, some might say, well, there must be another explanation for this, okay? Because dead people don't come back to life. Maybe he wasn't dead. And I think there are three things we can probably say to this. Have a look down verse 33. There are some Jews who come along with Mary and Martha and the gang. They're weeping. Now, it was common practice in those days when someone died to hire in professional mourners to kind of sort of make a song and a dance of it. It sounds weird, but that was the way you showed respect to those who died. And I guess it was a bit like the modern day equivalent of getting in funeral directors, right? So you only get them in when someone dies. Jesus is dead. Secondly, Lazarus's body has been in the tomb for 4 days, verse 39. You see, it's decomposing. That's why Martha says, "Don't open the tomb, it stinks." Thirdly, even if in some freak accident, and freak accidents do happen, Lazarus was alive when they put him in the tomb. He's been in there in a weak state for 4 days without food or drink and with a cloth around his face. Lazarus was dead. And well dead. In fact, I don't know if it's with intentional humor or not, verse 44, he's described as a dead man when he comes out, okay? He's described as a dead man. So please, let's not be snobbish and assume that people who lived 2,000 years ago didn't know when someone was dead. In fact, they were much more likely to know than we would, because death was a much more visible and public affair than it is today. And let's not assume that these witnesses were just unskeptical suckers hanging round and waiting for someone to be raised from the dead. In fact, in Jewish thinking at the time, No one expected one man to raise another from the dead. That sort of thinking just didn't exist, okay? So when Mary and Martha approach the tomb, no one is thinking, we know what's going to happen next. After all, look back at verse 23. Jesus has said to Martha, your brother will rise again. And she says, yes, I know he will at some point in the future. You see, she thinks Jesus is talking about this general resurrection that's going to happen in the future. It hasn't even occurred to her. Jesus is saying, no, I'm talking about what's going to happen in the next few minutes. So when Jesus goes to the tomb to roll away the stone, Martha isn't thinking, this is it. He's going to raise my brother. She's thinking, what is he on? No, Lazarus was dead. Verse 44, he's now alive. Here is the evidence to show Jesus is a crutch we can rely on. Now, you might have questions about the reliability of the Gospels. And if you want, you can ask about that afterwards or look up some talks on the Emmanuel website. But here is the evidence to show Jesus is a crutch. We can take comfort in Jesus' promises about life after death because he shows he's got the power to beat the monster. And his talk isn't cheap. Now, if you're skeptical about this, I'm sure you've got loads of questions. I'm not assuming that this has answered all of them. What I'm trying to show you is that there is evidence here that demands an explanation. And I think the most reasonable explanation is that Jesus did bring a dead man back to life. And if you haven't looked at the evidence as an adult, can I urge you to do that? But this also shows that you can't just put Jesus in a if he works for you kind of category, because death will come to us all. And so what Jesus says affects us all. He is the resurrection and the life. And he offers life after death to all who believe in him. These aren't just empty claims. This shows that God does not intend to let death have his way with us. And Jesus backs up these claims by pulling Lazarus from the strong arms of death. Nothing and no one else has this kind of power. Nothing and no one else can offer this kind of comfort. It's not a surprise that my cousin and her husband are leaning on Jesus as they get to grips with the possibility of raising a disabled child. The question is, who wouldn't want to live and lean on Jesus? Why would you lean on anything else? Why would you lean on your career or your family? They will not take your weight at the time when it counts. They might be great, but they will not take your weight. Lean on Jesus. He is the resurrection and the life, and he will take your full weight. I'm going to finish with a prayer using the words of a 17th century preacher named Thomas Brooks. And he sums up just how wonderful it is to lean on Jesus, to have him as a crutch. This is what he writes. We have all things in Christ, and Christ is all things to a Christian. If we be in darkness, he is light. If we be in poverty, he is plenty. If we be weak, he is strength. And if we fear death, he is life. Father, we thank you for giving us Jesus. We thank you that his words of promise bring comfort, that he is the resurrection and the life, and whoever believes in him will have life. And we thank you for his power. We thank you that his talk is not cheap. Amen.
Ian, thank you so much for your talk and for being so honest with us. We've got a few questions for you. First of all, just a quick clarification. What's a TED's talk?
I think I don't know what it stands for. Does anyone, what is it? Does anyone know what it stands for?
Technology, Education, Design.
Boom. There we go. TED Talks are great. If you haven't discovered TED Talk, go home and just type in TED Talks. And it's this vast depository of, like, interesting speakers talking engagingly about brilliant topics. That's a plug.
Great. Who created death, Ian? You've talked a lot about it. Who created death?
I'm not sure I see language about death being created in the Bible. But we do know from the very early chapters in Genesis, so that's the first book in the Bible which covers the issues of how the world came into existence. We see that God made the world and he made it well. And he made it with man and woman as the sort of high point of his creation, enjoying it, living with God and enjoying all his blessings, and with no reason to turn from him. And then, almost inexplicably, they do turn from him. And they say, no, we don't want to go your way. We want all the blessings you give us, but we want them from ourselves. We won't have you, thank you very much. And because they turn their back on the giver of life, they sort of turn their back on life itself, and death comes into the world. And from those very early chapters, when death comes in, God is saying, I am going to put it right. And it takes a long time, and then finally comes someone who will begin to fix things. And we see here in chapter 11 an example of Jesus showing us that monster, I've sort of described it like that of death, can in fact be defeated and made right. I'm not sure if you ask that question and you think he's totally dodged a bullet, come and see me afterwards.
Do. Why do you call it the monster? Why do you call death a monster?
Because I think it is. And I might not... You might think I've overhyped it, but if you come... Oh, man, I don't know. It seemed like that to me. It seemed horrible.
You see that in the scriptures too. It's never a good thing. So, as you said, something that Jesus was angry about. Yeah.
I think... Now, you might take the view, if you're a very firmly entrenched atheist, that death is sort of just the cells giving up. But it doesn't feel like that when it happens. It just doesn't feel like the end of a natural process. It feels very unnatural.
Someone here writes, a close family member died recently. And many other family members have said things like, he's at peace now, the angels are watching over him. How are we supposed to respond to a grieving family who are broken and desperate? Probably when we too ourselves are broken and desperate. Hmm.
I think the first thing to respond with is probably tears. That's what Jesus did in the face of grief. Do you know, as Christians, there's a danger we might respond. Something like that happens, and we can be very quick to say, "Oh, but of course, he and she they're with God now. Isn't that brilliant?" And actually, it's not brilliant. Someone's died. It's terrible. It's terrible that someone dies, and we need to be there with them and cry with them and actually perhaps say nothing for a long time. But we do have a specific hope and we can talk about it. Now, it depends if the person's a Christian or not, so there are all kinds of ways we need to be really sensitive about how we say that, but there is a hope. We can say that there is a solid hope, and you'll know the person and you'll know when it's right and when it's wrong to begin talking about those kinds of things.
Following on from that, It's a big question, but how can we offer comfort to those who have lost unbelieving friends or relatives?
I don't think whether a person is a Christian or not a Christian, I don't think that changes that our first response to suffering should be putting an arm around their shoulder or crying with them. Because it doesn't matter whether you're a Christian or not a Christian. It's still terrible. The wrench of death is still very painful. And so I think we're still there to offer them consolation. And we want to speak about a God who offers hope to all who turn to him. And at the right moment, we want to speak to them about the hope that's on offer for them. That is a hard question as well. And I'm sorry for having given a particularly good answer to it.
A good thing to be asking in small groups and asking each other. We need to help each other, particularly in those situations, more than we do, perhaps.
I think what we want to have in our minds, maybe something's come to mind, sorry, it takes me a while to process stuff, but at least we want to have in our minds that when something like that happens, it is an opportunity pointing people to say, do you know there is a God, and death does come to us all? Have you looked into Christianity? Have you looked into the claims of Jesus? And we can say that in our different ways. But that's surely something to at least kind of have in the back of our minds.
Thanks, Ian. What would you recommend if someone is thinking that I need to look into this a bit more? What would be your recommendation? What would be a next step for them?
If you were brought here by someone, then just go to the pub and chat to them about the questions. That's what I would say.
Great. Okay. Ian, thank you so much.